So the big question is this: how do investors like us get access to the ideas, information, and most importantly, the right people that give us the tools and information we need to make informed and educated decisions to have success? That is the question, and this podcast will give us the answers. This is Mark Moss, your host. Let's get this started.
Bitcoin is many things to many people. One reason why it's so hard to understand is because there's so many different things that you have to understand to really get it. There's a lot of things that excite me and other people about Bitcoin, including making money, of course, which attracts the most people, the ability to have a new money outside of the Fed, the ability to take away trust from major institutions, and so many other things. But one of the unintended consequences of Bitcoin that I really am excited about is it's got people to start paying attention. It's got people to pay attention and learn. It's got people interested in things like economics, Austrian economics, freedom, human violations, and things like that. And it's opened up people's minds. It's increased their enthusiasm to learn, their curiosity. And you know, one of the things that I've really put a lot of attention into over the last couple of years, as I've gone further and further into the Bitcoin rabbit hole, is the oppression that's happening around the world. The human rights violations. We're seeing it pop up more than ever right now. You know, there's half a dozen countries with 1 to 2 million people marching and protesting, and it's only getting worse. And today I am sitting down with Alex Gladstein. He's the chief strategy officer at the Human Rights Foundation. And we get into talking a little bit of the talk that he gave about how Bitcoin is going against, helping us fight back against Big Brother and the financial rights and how they're human rights. And so a really interesting conversation. We dive into those topics, different countries around the world, what they're facing. We talk about something he likes to call privacy capitalism, which is a real interesting topic. And anyway, it was a great conversation. If you want to know more about Bitcoin, financial privacy, financial sovereignty, and how we can fight back against Big Brother, then I definitely recommend that you listen. So let's jump right in. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Market Disruptors podcast. Today, I'm joined by Alex Gladstein. He is the Chief Strategy Officer at the Human Rights Foundation, as well as faculty at the Singularity University. He's been doing a lot of work in human rights and specifically technology, Bitcoin, et cetera, that can free us. And so I've been looking forward to this conversation. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So, you know, we've had a couple conversations. I've seen some of your videos that you're doing. I love the work that you're doing in the space that you're doing it. I think it's super important for the revolution that we're kind of seeing. But for those that don't know what you've been doing, why don't you give us a little background on yourself and what you're doing?
Sure. So since 2007, I've been working for a nonprofit called the Human Rights Foundation, which focuses on promoting civil liberties and human rights for people who live under authoritarian regimes. So by our count, that's about 93 countries, 4 billion people who live under a government that's either a one-party state or a kingdom or a dictatorship of some kind where there's no real separation of powers or free and fair elections or free expression or ability to really hold your government accountable or even write an op-ed in a newspaper. These are places where independent media is either persecuted or non-existent. This ranges from the extremely oppressive, like North Korea or Eritrea, all the way through countries like China, Vietnam, Venezuela, Russia, Saudi Arabia. Unfortunately, it really runs the gamut. So we specialize in helping people who live under these very difficult political environments. And technology has always been a huge part of this, whether it's by when I first started sending in DVDs to the Cuban underground library movement so that Cubans could access stories and narratives that were forbidden, to our work with North Korea, where we smuggled in tens of thousands of flash drives and USB sticks and SD cards packed with movies and films about the outside world, to work with people who are doing everything from mesh networks to encrypted communications to, you know, using satellites even to expose human rights violations. So technology has always been an interesting tool for good, but then of course we're also seeing how, you know, governments like China are using technology to perfect social engineering, and other governments are using technology to shut off the internet and keep their people isolated. So it's kind of a two sides of the narrative. But I very much believe in technologies that are empowering and decentralizing as pretty essential to the future of human rights.
Now, when you talk about human rights as a whole, categorically, I guess, first of all, you talk about 93 countries, 40 billion people. I guess even the freest country, America, the land of the free, is still maybe, you know, not totally free. So I guess it's like a sliding scale, right? There's no black and white
definition. Yeah, there's like Norway. It's like Norway to North Korea, right?
Right.
So you've got Norway where like it's pretty much the most open and arguably free country by most metrics. All the way down to North Korea, which is the least open and free.
Yeah, so you have that's
kind of, yeah, there's no black and white, but there is actually something called a town square test that the Soviet dissident Natan Sharansky invented, where, you know, think about it. Can you go to the center of your town or city or village or wherever you live and criticize the government openly? And, you know, for about 93 countries, you can't do that. Like, you can't do that without risk of getting fired or, you know, without risk of getting kidnapped, killed, et cetera.
Yeah.
Here in America, while I agree that we have many problems, like, people make a living off making fun of the president. They make actually quite a healthy living doing so on many different networks. So, you know, we have a really vibrant tradition of free expression here, which is really, really important. And this is the same in many other countries around the world to different extents. But generally speaking, you do need to apply some sort of political science rigor to this and actually differentiate. I mean, the sort of people on the internet who compare America to North Korea are wrong, I believe. And there is a real difference in terms of how the American government is essentially built by the people in many ways, where we can hold our government accountable. And the people who make all the decisions rotate through based on voting. And we have free expression, and we have like close to 100,000 nonprofits, and we have the ACLU and the EFF, and we can sue our government. And, you know, there's like a lot of investigative journalism. This is like super, super different from like Belarus or Gabon, where like they don't have any of that. So again, I think it's really important to draw that distinction.
Yeah, definitely. I guess I was just saying it's like this sliding scale. There's no black and white defining like line that separates.
Right. Well, you know, there is, but there isn't. I mean, if you look at the Korean Peninsula, there's a very clear demarcation, very clear line that you can look at from a nighttime satellite image, which shows literally the difference between freedom and dictatorship. On one side, you have a free country that has a democracy and incredible economic innovation, where they make all the stuff in your pockets and on the roads, et cetera. And on the other side, you just have darkness. So, I mean, there are some more of these lines around the world. I mean, you could argue Belarus and Estonia, right? And there are a few others, but, you know, arguably, it can be pretty stark.
Yeah. I've seen the satellite images of that, exactly what you're talking about. And it is pretty amazing to see. It amazes me when you look back through time and you look at, you know, from the time we were kind of owned as by kings or whatnot, you know, and dictatorships and then all the way to today, how with the age of information that we have, it just seems strange that even today you could be owned by a country, right? Like you don't have the freedom to do what you want or move as you want. A lot of that, I guess a lot of that then is the countries want that. They just want the control, and that's why they're trying to utilize this technology.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a evolutionary path. Governments have always wanted to have more control over their people, whether in the name of national security, stability, prosperity, you name it. It's always been a game of, you know, we need to have more power and control to protect you, right?
Yeah.
Dating back all the way to early societies, right? So today, it's done with a different kind of clothing, let's put it that way. But even in, as you're saying, even in advanced democracies, we have serious concerns over, you know, is encryption going to be legal? You know, can we have private communications? You've got even governments as advanced democratically as England and Australia trying to outlaw encryption. So this is a struggle struggle for freedom is something that's present everywhere. But, you know, over hundreds and thousands of years, like there has been a pretty amazing progress made whereby compared to 1,000 years ago when everybody lived under a dictatorship, you know, today you can clearly say like approximately half the world, approximately, you know, 3.5 or so billion people live under a government that they can sort of collectively control, right? And that's a big difference. So that's kind of inspiring. So that kind of keeps us moving forward. So these big decentralizing progressive trends like democracy versus dictatorship, or like the open internet versus what we used to have, which was like state and elite control of information. These are like really, really positive trends, and they're pretty undeniable. And that third one that we want to talk about is money, right? So is Bitcoin. So, you know, Bitcoin is like the culmination of many different kinds of technologies and methods and mechanisms, but essentially it's given us a way to separate money from state and really decentralize the means of production of money and access to money in a way where anyone can have permission in permissionless access to this sort of really intriguing asset. So yeah. I would like to think of like the political science backdrop that we just kind of covered and like how mankind has made progress in areas of like decentralized political power or what we would call probably democracy. And also in other areas where we've made progress in terms of like, you know, having the average person have access to almost all the information in the world is pretty amazing in the form of a smartphone. And then we're just on the cusp of this third one, which is like having everyone having access essentially to Bitcoin, which is something we've never seen before.
Yeah. And that's what I wanted to jump in and talk about. A recent talk that you gave, which I watched, was Bitcoin versus Big Brother. And, you know, we're looking at Bitcoin as a technology and how they say how it fixes this, right? It fixes everything. And I had mentioned before we started recording how I see this race of technology where technology working to enslave us versus technology that could potentially free us. You kind of talked about privacy capitalism and whatnot. And where does Bitcoin fit into that technology to free us versus the technology to slave us?
Yeah. I was pointing out a interesting idea to play with, which is, of course, you've heard of Big Brother, which is like, you know, technologically enabled government that can have omniscient surveillance, right? And then we've heard of surveillance capitalism, which is this swiftly growing industry of companies that want to know as much about you as possible,
right?
So that they can make more money. So why not privacy capitalism, right? So, you know, what could we see? Have we already seen the beginning of, and will we see more of this idea of like companies whose like product or service is to help people protect themselves? So you've already seen a lot of this with regard to like encrypted messaging, like the folks who created Signal obviously did well, you know, selling their tech to, you know, different companies.
Yep.
You've already seen this, of course, with like, you know, obviously Bitcoin and Bitcoin related technologies and companies.
Yep.
With regard to people who want control and privacy over their financial transactions.
You have like VPN companies, maybe, for example.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, look, Tunnel Bear was sold for $400 million to McAfee. So, I mean, I just think like if we just fast forward 10, 20 years, like especially more wealthy people, I think they're going to want privacy. Like, right? So historically, that's why Swiss banks were so appealing. I mean, for, you know, we could argue about the moral reasons, but like clearly, like there was a business model to give financial privacy to wealthy people. Like Swiss banks made a lot of money, right? So, you know, now we're seeing maybe like the ability for perhaps like a lot more people than just the ultra high net worth and dictators or whatever to be able to protect and their communications and privacy. Like we're basically getting like with all this open source, powerful defensive technology that's spreading around the world, like we're kind of being able to democratize the ability for people to keep things to themselves, which I think is really, really important in the age of Big Brother and surveillance capitalism. So maybe we're at the beginning of something where we're going to see really healthy, profitable industries pop up where byproducts and services are actually defending people's privacy and civil liberties. That would be really neat.
Yeah,
I don't think the change is going to come altruistically, unfortunately. Like I think people are going to want to, you know, make money. But maybe they can make money and help make the world more private at the same time.
Yeah, I hope so. I as you said, right? Like right now, it's the surveillance tech, and that's something that, you know, I've seen people talk out about. Kyle Bass is a well-known investor, and he's been talking about how like U.S. and Wall Street greed, corporate greed, is like helping fuel China for this surveillance state.
Totally.
And so, like, the fact that they're putting their money in and bowing down to China only empowers them more. And it's motivated by greed. So hopefully, I guess greed could swing to the other side, right? Is what you're saying.
Yeah, but those guys know what they're doing. I mean, they know exactly what they're doing. And I'm willing to bet that they don't want to see what they're building in China, in their own homes and in their own communities, right? So at the end of the day, all these investors and, you know, corporate titans who are helping build, you know, the next version of the Great Firewall, they don't want that at home. So I think they're quite aware and cognizant of what they're doing. And that's unfortunate. Shame on them. But there's going to be a thirst and a desire for protection mechanisms against the very things that they build. I mean, you can even see this in the, like when you listen to interviews or talk to, you know, the famous creators of things like, you know, the iPhone or Facebook or whatever. Oftentimes these people don't even want their kids using technology, right?
So
I think there's a very powerful mechanism here where I think a lot of these people know more than they let on, and they know exactly what's happening in China. They know what's happening even in parts of the free world, and they don't want that to happen like on a personal level, right? With their family, right? So I think there is going to be this desire to protect us against the oncoming onslaught of surveillance, both from companies and governments. And I think that market will only grow. I mean, look, we've got, what is it, 80 million daily active users of Signal? I mean, could it be 500 million in 5 years? Maybe. I don't know. I like, for example, none of my friends use encrypted messaging 5 years ago. Right, and every day I see more people, oh, this person joined Signal, this person joined Signal. You know, you get that little message.
Like, yeah, I've been getting a lot of them.
And Signal's just one of many, many messengers that purport to have encryption. But I think it's coming, man. I think it's coming.
That's if the governments allow it, right? As you mentioned, right, like with Australia with their encryption laws. So obviously China won't allow it. Now Australia won't allow it. And maybe it goes to Europe next.
You can, you know, dude, it's like the drug. It's like, you know, marijuana. Like, what are they going to do? Outlaw encryption? You know, guess what? People are still going to use it. Like,
right.
You know, this, but, you know, like outlawing marijuana was like one of the dumbest policy decisions of the century in America. And it led to just a disastrous prison system, huge violations of human rights, et cetera. I don't know that, and it was not effective. Like, it made marijuana more popular, arguably, and more expensive. So I don't know if banning things like encryption or Bitcoin are going to lead to like favorable outcomes for governments. It may make them more expensive and more desirable. And because they are open source and decentralized, and there's no single point of failure for this stuff, like, you can't kill it. It's like basically an idea. So governments have to be very careful the way that they like approach these things.
Yeah. And with marijuana, I mean, it's a physical thing that has to be grown in the space. And
exactly. And that was impossible to eradicate. I mean, now we have stuff where you can memorize the private key to your messages or your Bitcoin in your head and like walk around and not have it written down anywhere, or even, you know, on any piece of, you don't even have to have it on a USB stick or on your phone. It can be just in your mind. So I think it's, you know, the confiscation resistant nature of Bitcoin and the more sovereign element of some of these encrypted messaging apps is very intriguing
and I think the other thing is that, you know, there has to be a need for it. So a lot of times people are like, well, we need more adoption, but like you need a need for it. And then what you see in countries with these problems, you know, what's going on in Hong Kong or Iran with their bank shut down or Lebanon or whatever, they're pushing the need for it. And so we're starting to see in those areas the rise of this new technology, like mesh networks, as you referenced before, right? So like, it's almost like they're doing our marketing for us, like, hey, here, you know, here's a big problem, go find a solution for it.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. I'd like to think so. But and back to that talk, you talked about Bitcoin versus Big Brother. I mean, do you think like that's like the ultimate tool that we have now because it relates to our money, and maybe one, money is our first thing we should control?
Well, the point of the talk was just to underline how important financial privacy is going to be as we become more digital in our lives. Like, I still don't think people quite understand the importance of how we are moving from money being the money that we use every day being a bearer asset, which is anonymous. Like, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever. Like, anytime you made a transaction, it was anonymous. Like, the government did not like know about you.
Yeah.
Bought something with a $5 bill, and like the merchant doesn't know your name, your address, your last transaction, your email address, whatever. Like, they didn't have this big fat identity stack on you immediately, like they do now whenever you use your credit card or touchless pay or whatever. And like the logical conclusion of that is something like WeChat, where like they know like a massive amount of information about you. And at the same time, they've developed like big data analysis, like quote unquote AI technology, to be able to actually analyze all that data. Like, credit cards have been around for a long time,
right?
But we didn't have the AI big data analysis stuff for companies and governments to really effectively sift through all that data and like do predictive analysis and things like that until the last 15 years. So we're in a new age, and paper money obviously is on the way out. It's already
out.
Single digit percentage of all daily transactions in today's world, and in some places like Sweden, urban China, whatever. It's like, people don't use cash. People being born today will never use paper money. So we have to think very carefully about digital cash and why we need digital cash. And it's because we don't want to live in a world where all of our behaviors and transactions are spied on and exploited.
Yeah, it's so powerful. You know, it's like not what I say, it's what I do. And what we're doing is spending our money. I've seen reports of like Target and their big data and how they can analyze purchases, and they may know when someone's going to become pregnant before they even know it. And that's the kind of scary stuff that it leads to.
Yeah, and I think that, look, especially with regard to finance, like, your spend says more about you than your words, right?
Right.
So if I want to spy on you, I want to know what your bank account is, not necessarily, what you're doing on social media. So it's kind of like the truth about you is your spending habits, right? So yeah, we want to keep that stuff private. And look, I'm not like I'm not actually anywhere close to being like an anarchist or anything. I believe in good governance, but sure. I think we as a society need to have like negotiations and compromises where, like, we compromise the people using technology as our lever. We force a compromise whereby, and this is legal and moral precedent, where money under a certain amount of value per day transactions could be anonymous, and the government would just have to sort of be okay with that. So, for example, like, you can think of gift cards today as a really good like precedent, both technologically, morally, legally. I can walk into a store and buy several hundred dollars of gift cards with cash, and then I can go buy stuff on the internet completely anonymously, right? If I want to. I mean, maybe I have to enter in, data and things like that to buy things. But generally speaking, you can pay for certain things without divulging your information using gift cards, which is pretty amazing. So the U.S. government has no problem with that. Like, and that's something we want to encourage them to continue to not have a problem with.
Right.
I mean, really, like, from a legal perspective, what we're talking about with like Bitcoin transactions being as seamless as gift cards, like using stuff like Lightning, perhaps, if that becomes more mature and usable, again, legally and morally, it wouldn't be very different from using gift cards, right? And a very large population of the US uses gift cards. I mean, something like 25% of the US people are underbanked, right? So a lot of them use gift cards anyway. So I don't know, we need to start having this debate I think this is why groups like Coin Center are important. In addition to developing the technology, we need to, have these conversations with politicians and try to encourage them to not take our rights and freedoms away. And sometimes it may work. Look, it may work in America. It's certainly not going to work in China. But look, we have a system and a culture where we could credibly say, like, cash is like an American value, right? And privacy is an American value. And it's literally in our constitution. So I think that even though we've seen all this stuff been unearthed with Snowden, et cetera, lately, I think there's a chance that we can have some sort of like social compromise in a place like America. But you know what? Like, zero chance of that happening in China, right? Or in Saudi Arabia or in any other dictatorship. So that's why it's kind of like, regardless of the legal moral situation, the tech is just got to be built. And you know what? It exists and it's not possible to stop. So at least that's exciting.
Yeah. The problem that the United States has is that the United States has the benefit of being the world's reserve currency. So they really have everything to lose. And that's what we've seen in Congress. As you know, Rep. Brad Sherman's talked about many times, like, we lose the ability to do sanctions and things like that. And so the U.S., while, yeah, being built on free grounds or whatever, has the most to lose.
Yeah. Yeah, but that may not, you know, don't take that for granted. I just read this brilliant book. It's called The Mandibles. M-A-N-D-I-B-L-E-S. Highly recommend it to all your listeners as a holiday gift. It has nothing to do with Bitcoin, but it basically tells the story of a near future U.S. where the dollar basically fails, where like a nationalist government reneges on our debt and treasury, right, you know, crash, and the rest of the world creates a currency called Bancor, inspired by what Keynes had come up with at the Bretton Woods summit. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I won't give away more than that, but it's so fascinating because it walks you through what a monetary crash and what hyperinflation would look like in America, whereby, you know, our friends in Venezuela, they know exactly what it looks like. And it's a total disaster, but I feel like a lot of Americans may struggle to connect with that because they're just assuming that the dollar will always be mighty. Right.
Right.
Well, it may not be. Right. I think even it would not be crazy to say that, like, there could be a crazy fatal dollar event in the next decade. Right. So this one happens to take place in 2029. Right. So this could happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, with that in mind, like, people need to think about how assets work and how savings works, even just for their own families. Like, a big theme of the Mandibles book is that even wealthy people, they all get wiped out because all their assets are like controlled by banks or like dollar denominated, or like, it's just not like, and when the news hits, if there's a big when the news hits in Argentina or Lebanon, there's going to be like bank controls or whatever.
Right.
You don't have a lot of time.
Right.
Like, you know, you got no time, so you're toast. Right. So maybe that money that's in that savings account or dollar denominated, whatever savings account of some kind you have, or you have pension or whatever you have, you know, if that's going to continue to be denominated in a currency which is crashing, then you're screwed, right? So you need to think about other kinds of assets. And that's what makes Bitcoin so compelling, is because it's a permissionless asset that anyone can access. Anyone can buy whatever amount, $1, $5, 50 cents. They don't need to be wealthy. It's like the great equalizer. Anyone can access a small amount of Bitcoin or a large amount, but they can like take their time and energy and turn it into an asset that cannot be devalued by a government in any situation. And that's like really, really incredible to me. So if you think about like the way that poorer people save around the world, like they do things like they buy cows or sheet metal, and these things aren't very liquid and they're hard to trade. I mean, this is such an upgrade. I mean, all they need is a phone and internet access, and they can own an asset, own the private key to an asset that cannot be devalued. Now, of course, it's going to be quite volatile for a long time, I think.
Sure. But it has to be volatile.
That volatility goes up, man. I mean, it's a one-way volatility. So over time. So, you know, we've gone from dollars to tens of dollars to hundreds of dollars to thousands of dollars, right? It's going that way, right? Not up to tens of thousands of dollars. So I think it's just kind of an exciting innovation, and it comes at the right time.
Yeah,
it's very ironic that it was born in 2008 and 2009, and I think Bitcoin, both for privacy and also in the face of economic stability, will be a very, very important phenomenon moving forward.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was saying. Where now with all these things we're seeing happening around the world, it's almost like they're just pushing people to this stuff. I'm curious though to draw back to what you're mainly working on, which is, you know, working with people under human rights foundations or violations, I should say. And it seems like, you know, today there's half a dozen countries kind of erupting and whatnot, and we're seeing starting to see human rights violations happening more and more. But you're talking about this all the time, like, Are you trying to get like regular people like in the United States to be aware of that so they can help you guys provide resources to that?
Yeah. I mean, look, we're a charity, so we only can do what we do because of the generosity of our donors. And generally speaking, our supporters tend to be people who appreciate freedom, who either live in a free society or they've like escaped from a closed or closing society. Right.
Right.
And they want to, through HRF, help people who aren't as fortunate. Let's put it that way.
And the reason why I wanted to ask that is, trying to get people involved to care about human rights violations and want to be involved. I would imagine, especially in the US, it's hard because everything's so good here. I can't imagine it ever being bad. They don't care. And maybe there's some correlation with that, with talking to people about Bitcoin the same way. We're like, well, I don't see that problem. I don't care.
Well, here's the thing. Bitcoin's a game changer. It's very difficult to get people to care about human rights. You're right. Because there's no, you know, you don't get anything in return, right? It's you have to have like extremely like low time preference thinking generally to want to support human rights, because it's something that takes a long time to manifest the fruits.
Right.
But generally speaking, it was hard for me to talk about things like privacy and freedom pre-Bitcoin, harder. Now that like people are intrigued, because everybody's interested in money, right, and price and all these things, it is really interesting, because it does allow me to, for example, come on a show like yours, where like if Bitcoin didn't exist, I'm just guessing,
right,
you'd probably be less interested in talking about human rights. All of a sudden, we've had this like
definitely
half an hour conversation about freedom and human rights. Like it's a game changer from that respect, because it is the intersection of money and profit and value and freedom and human rights, right? So that's why Bitcoin's such a interesting game changer here. And I'm just trying to rely on it and use it and understand it in a way that can help protect and defend people's freedoms, which are at risk. And I think it's a real asset, not just physically, technically, you know, economically, but also educationally.
Definitely. I couldn't agree more. I've said that a lot of times. One of the biggest things about Bitcoin, even if it didn't succeed, is that it's got people to want to learn more, ask questions, and pay attention to these things, as you're saying, because you're right. I probably wouldn't be near as interested in human rights violations and things like this if I wasn't paying attention to Bitcoin. So I guess an unintended consequence. That's very good. All right. Well, that's good stuff. I think we can kind of wrap it up on that. Again, like I said, I know you're doing the work on human rights violations, right, through the foundation. You said it's mainly through donors and whatnot. So where do people learn more about that?
Yeah, they can check out hrf.org or follow us on Twitter at HRF. Contact me on Twitter at Gladstein, GLADSTEIN. I also, if people are interested more about the sort of political economic background and impact of Bitcoin, I wrote a book this summer with a few other really interesting co-authors from around the world called The Little Bitcoin Book, which is on Amazon. It's a short read, 100 pages. Also probably makes for a fun holiday gift.
Was that with Jimmy Song?
Yeah. Jimmy Song and Elena Varnova and Lily Liu and a bunch of others. So it's Luis Buenaventura, Timmy Ajibuye, Alex Lloyd, Alejandro Machado. It was fun. We got together and tried to put why we think Bitcoin matters into a short kind of long, I guess like a short book or a very long essay. So people can check that out. It's got pretty good reviews. So check us out at HRF, check out the book, and let's stay in touch.
All right, Alex, thanks for taking the time. Appreciate all the hard work that you're putting in to bring awareness to this stuff.
My pleasure.
All right.
Hey, if you like this episode of the Market Disruptors podcast, please help us take this to the top of the podcast charts. Just please do me a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. Taking 15 seconds to just leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us reach more people and disrupt more markets. I really appreciate you listening, and I'll see you next time on the Market Disruptors podcast.